Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're live at the Olentangy River Wetlands Research Center at Ohio State University. Today with me right now is Cy Montgomery. We're going to talk about her new book. If you hurry, you can still join us this beautiful morning outside the Hefner Wetland Research and Education Building. Cy's new book about birds isn't intended to acquaint us with every species, but what she sees as the seven essential truths about birds, explained through her experiences with seven species that best represent those truths. The book is called Birdology, Adventures with a Pack of Hens, a Peck of Pigeons, Cantankerous Crows, Fierce Falcons, Hip-Hop Parrots, Baby Hummingbirds, and One Murderously Big Living Dinosaur. Cy Montgomery, welcome to the Olentangy River Wetlands Research Park, and welcome to the show.
I'm thrilled to be here, especially with all these birds.
And the honking frog somewhere out there. If anyone notices that, it's like a foghorn.
I hope he joins us.
And I keep checking out to see if I can find him, but it's a beautiful day out here, and can't think of a better place to talk about birds, because one of the advantages of the wetlands is it attracts birds that feed from the kind of things that grow in wetlands. So
yeah, we've been walking around this incredible place and seeing lots of them.
It's one of the best in the world. You know, you've written many books for children, for adults, about all sorts of things animal. You've always wanted to write a book about birds, but in the introduction you said that you're glad you waited till now. Why is that?
Well, birds are hard to get your head around. They are at once very like us, to the point that birds alone, of all the creatures who have ever lived, including some people say Neanderthals, who were humans, of all the creatures that have ever lived, they can speak to us in our own language meaningfully. A chimp can't even do that. So they're very like us, and yet, on the other hand, they're extremely unlike us. We're made of different stuff. You and I are made of heavy fluids. They're made of air. They're more closely related to dinosaurs than they are to us. And yet you can have this deep and meaningful relationship with them. So I think I needed 30 years to think about this to be ready to write it.
You made some wonderful friends along the way.
Yeah, of all the books I've done, this has just been amazing. I've been everywhere from Australia to New England to research this, and every time we turn around, I'm meeting some wonderful avian and human people who I hope are going to be part of my life forever.
People who work with birds, in reading the book, they always seemed like a certain kind of person, very patient, not very necessarily loud. I don't know. Was there did you notice any kind of pattern with the kind of people that work so closely with birds?
Well, you have to be a good listener, for one thing. And you have to listen with your whole body, you know, not just with your ears. You listen, you're paying attention with your whole body, with all that your senses can bring to it, and all that your heart, your intuition, your emotions, all of that you have to bring to a relationship with a bird, I think. And so maybe this is why I was so blessed with extraordinary people. But then look at the people I got to meet, you know. For one of my chapters, I worked with a hummingbird rehabilitator who specializes in rescuing and releasing orphaned baby hummingbirds.
Which are the size of your fingernail when they're born. Or a bumblebee?
Yeah, they're... Oh, dear.
Okay?
This isn't going to work. Sorry. When they're born, they hatch out of eggs the size of a navy bean. And they're born the size of a bumblebee. So to take care of something like that, imagine the patience and the tenderness that you need, the attention that you have to pay to it. And Brenda Sherburn, the woman who I worked with, showed all of these things. She's like a Mother Teresa, you know. She's like a combination of Mother Teresa and the little Dutch boy with his finger in the dike. Because they're so vulnerable.
Birds, this is an interesting aspect of the whole story that struck me, and I thought about it a lot on my walk this morning with my dog, is that birds are the only wild animals that most people see every day. And I really hadn't, even squirrels, I don't see squirrels. I mean, but birds are always with us.
That's right. And that's why I felt it was so important to write about them. I mean, I've written in my other books about everything from the bird, the giant Goliath bird-eating tarantula, to tree kangaroos in Papua New Guinea. But here's animals that we see every day, and yet we don't know them. You know, we don't realize that they're individuals. We don't realize that they are dinosaurs. We don't realize that they are made of air. We just don't recognize who they are. And if we did, we would be awestruck. And that's what I want to accomplish with this book, is to make us fall in love again and be awestruck again by these really common beings.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Cy Montgomery, author of Birdology. It's a book about birds. She's also the best-selling author of The Good, Good Pig and many children's books, and is well-known. You're here. Your visit here in Columbus in Central Ohio is co-hosted by the Columbus Zoo and the Grage Insurance Audubon Center. We talked about that earlier. Tonight at 7 p.m., you'll be at the Grange Insurance Audubon Center at 505 West Whittier. We'll have a link on our website, wosu.org/allsides, with more information about that. There'll be a reception and a book signing, too, but it does cost $10. So check the website out, get more information at wosu.org/allsides. Cy, birds are so different from us, yet in reading yours, and I read about, you know, Wesley the owl, I've read about him before, they possess emotional and intellectual abilities remarkably like ours, but the idea that they have the personalities that they have is somewhat new to me. It's been in the last few years from reading and meeting and, you know, just being a journalist that I've learned about the idea that a chicken has a personality.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, that's essential to know about birds. When we see birds, they're often in great big flocks, and we need to realize that everybody in that flock is an individual whose upbringing and individual personality really sculpts not only who they are, but may sculpt who their flock is as a culture. And I found this out working with chickens. For 20 years, I've raised chickens in New Hampshire, where I live in Hancock, with my husband and border collie, and for many years with a wonderful pig who got to 750 pounds. And my 20 years with this flock helped me to realize just how distinctive each bird is. And chickens, you know, they're not usually considered great paragons of intelligence, but they are extremely intelligent, and they are extremely social. For example, my chickens, they not only know me, they know that the average chicken, researchers have determined the average chicken can recognize at least 100 individuals, and they recognize them by their faces the same way we recognize each other. But my chickens know the neighbors, and they know the neighbors across the street who they don't like, and then the neighbors to one side, our next-door neighbors, they love them so much that whenever Jarvis and Bobby Coffin come out of their house, they hear that back door slam, and the chickens, the whole flock runs over, their arms akimbo, you know, trying to propel themselves even faster, so that Bobby and Jarvis will pick them up and pet them and maybe give them a little bit of corn. And sometimes Bobby and Jarvis, if they have to go somewhere and don't have time for my chickens, they sneak out. They have to stealth their way out of their house so the chickens don't see them and mob them.
You say in the book that you became an honorary chicken.
Yes. Well, you may have heard of the term imprinting, which is a term coined by Conrad Lorenz, who was the founder of modern ethology, or the study of animal behavior. And there's certain birds who hatch out of the egg, and right away they can walk, they can peck, they can do all kinds of good things like that. And that's known as the precocial hatching strategy. Chickens are like that. When they hatch out, the first moving object they see, it's usually their mom. So they are actually imprinted on that moving object and adopted as their mom. Well, my babies actually come in the mail. They're still shaped like eggs when they arrive, and really the first moving object that they're going to see is me. And I raise them in my office at home. I have a home office, and I usually have a chick sitting on my lap or in my shirt or on my head with predictable results, but who cares? And they consider me a chicken. And so this lets me travel in the chicken universe and get to see a little of what it's like to be a chicken. And it is far more complex and interesting than any of us would ever suspect.
Now, you know, I'm sure you're aware that there are controversies popping up in urban centers around the country where people want to start having backyard chickens, and not huge flocks, but just a few. And some people oppose it. They say they're filthy and they don't belong in a backyard.
Well, they're certainly not filthy. I mean, people are filthy. chickens are not filthy at all. People say pigs are filthy, and that just is completely ignorant. It's if people keep animals in a place where they can't keep themselves clean when they're jammed into too small an area. But the animals themselves are not at all filthy, and birds are obsessively clean animals. They're constantly cleaning their feathers. They're bathing when they bathe in water or in dust, and they're very, very clean. I'd rather live next door to a chicken than a person.
You know, I thought it was interesting you pointed out in the book, too, that when you look up the word chicken in a dictionary, I can't remember if you cited a particular dictionary or not, but the first reference to it is as a piece of something that we consume.
Yes,
it's
that
food.
Was actually online. I was astonished. It's so much fun to look things up, either in dictionaries or online, just to see what comes up. And, yeah, it said the meat of a chicken. They didn't even say it was a bird. Yeah. It was appalling. But, you know, this is our problem with chickens. Our relationship with chickens is mostly of a culinary nature. And that really kind of wastes a lot of good relationship. having known chickens as long as I do, I have tremendous respect for powers they have that I don't, as well as powers that I have but might not have otherwise recognized in another being. For instance, roosters and the females, the hens too, can tell their flock what they see. They can tell the hens whether there's an overhead predator like a hawk. They can also, in their own language, their calls, say whether there's a ground predator, whether it's approaching rapidly or whether it's far away. They can announce when food has been found and whether it's particularly tasty food or whether it's not all that thrilling. I mean, they're communicating a lot. And folks who have studied them have actually measured this in scientific laboratories, so there's absolutely no doubt that this is the case.
We're going to take a short break now. My guest is Cy Montgomery. She's author of Birdology, Adventures with a Pack of Hens, a Peck of Pigeons, Cantankerous Crows, Fierce Falcons, Hip-Hop Parrots, Baby Hummingbirds, and One Murderously Big Living Dinosaur. Can't wait to hear about that. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Sunday night at 8 on WOSU-TV, watch the annual broadcast of the National Memorial Day Concert live from the West Lawn of the U.S. Capitol. The event honors the service and sacrifice of men and women in uniform, their families at home, and all those who have given their lives for our country. Co-hosted by Gary Sinise and Joe Montagna, the evening includes an all-star lineup of dignitaries, actors, and musical artists. Join the celebration Sunday night at 8 on WOSU-TV for the National Memorial Day Concert. And it is currently 80 degrees in downtown Columbus. Sunshine today, a high of 85. Clear skies tonight, a low of 62. Sunshine for Thursday, and a high of 85. There is a slight chance of rain Thursday night. And All Sides with Ann Fisher, live from the Olentangy Wetlands, continues right here on WOSU 820, NPR News. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're broadcasting live from the Olentangy River Wetlands Research Center at OSU today, and you can still join us on this beautiful morning. It's somehow cooling off. It must be that I'm getting a little bit more shade than I was at the start. My guest is Cy Montgomery, author of Birdology. It's got a great subtitle, so I'm going to say it. Adventures with a Pack of Hens, a Peck of Pigeons, Cantankerous Crows, Fierce Falcons, Hip-Hop Parrots, Baby Hummingbirds, and One Murderously Big Living Dinosaur. Welcome back to the show, Cy.
Thank you. I'm thrilled to be here.
We got that headphone situation worked out. We're all nice and comfy cozy here underneath our tent at the Hefner Center. The frog is croaking intermittently, so maybe our listeners can hear that as well. The seven essential truths about birds is kind of how you broke up the book. I like the idea that, and you got to this a little bit earlier, but the fact that they can apprehend the world in ways that we cannot, that we have this sense of superiority. Always we do, humans do, but it's been proven over and over again it's not the case at all. It just depends on what your goal is.
Absolutely. They have senses that we don't. They have extensions of our senses that we don't. For instance, they can see polarized light. They can see the magnetism of the Earth. They have all these senses that they can use to do things we cannot, such as complete their astonishing migrations, which are miraculous. And goodness, they're capable of flying. What else do we need to
in a way that we cannot even come close
no,
to how they fly?
No. In fact, this is one of my favorite little statistics from the book. A baby hummingbird grows up to a creature who can actually outstrip the space shuttle. If you're looking at body length, the space shuttle, when it screams down to Earth, is actually, per body length, going at a slower rate than an Allen's hummingbird doing his nuptial dive. If you're looking at how many body lengths per second he's diving, and that astonishes me.
You know, we have some sound of a hummingbird, which I want to hear because, there goes the frog again. We have some sound of a hummingbird that I want to hear because I really didn't know that they made sounds.
Yeah, we don't think of that.
So let's hear that. I mean, they're noisy.
No.
Where did that come from?
I know. Well, so many times with hummingbirds, you just don't know what they're doing because they're so fast, you can barely see them. Until the invention of the stroboscope, we could not even tell how they were accomplishing flight because their wings went so fast, we couldn't see them more than 80 times a second. So we needed this machine to slow it down to see that when a hummingbird flies, it's actually doing a power stroke. Every stroke, it's a figure eight that they're using to fly.
Like a butterfly in the pool, sort of a thing.
Yeah, sort of like that. Mm-hmm. And there's so many things that birds do in a hidden way. That's astonishing and thrilling to know that they're accomplishing these miracles without our knowledge. On the other hand, some birds afford us a chance to see all kinds of great behaviors if we just bother to look. For example, pigeons. Everybody sees pigeons all the time, and everyone ignores them. They call them rats with wings or living bust exhaust. But these birds, they're magnificent. You can watch a pigeon go through almost everything any bird does, including courtship, doing its whole mating thing, flying around, orienting to the sun, and you can see it year-round because they will lay eggs and mate year-round at close range, and you can observe this if we only bother to do so.
I had an expert on direction one time. I interviewed him, and he said that pigeons have a better sense of direction than most humans.
Oh, certainly better than me. Gosh, I'm one of those people that I live in New Hampshire, and every time I go into Massachusetts, I end up being sucked into the Sumner Tunnel to the airport completely against my will. But this does not happen with pigeons. And they are these species, even though they are non-migratory, they are studied more than any other to understand the secrets of migration. They use homing pigeons or racing pigeons, and there's a whole chapter on that in the book. I apprenticed myself a little bit to some pigeon racers. A pigeon race is the strangest thing you ever saw, and I happened to be observing pigeon races at the same time as the Kentucky Derby, and boy, is there a difference. For pigeon races, they let these pigeons go maybe 250 miles from the loft where each pigeon lives. Each pigeon has a different finish line, or each group of pigeons, because they want to go back to their home loft, and all of these pigeons live at different lofts. And so if there's a finish line in different places, how do you tell who wins? Well, they calculate the rate at which they fly. And so, you know, from the release site, they know exactly how far this loft is and that loft is. But the whole race takes place unseen. And the exciting part of the race is there you are, sitting in the backyard, waiting hours later for a pigeon to land. But it was surprisingly exciting, actually, to watch this. And I became very fond of both the pigeons and the people, who had tremendous respect for these birds, who are very family-oriented. One reason that pigeons will race so hard to get back to their home loft is they want to get back to their mates. They want to get back to their children, to their eggs.
Are homing pigeons, is that an instinct with them, or are they trained to return?
It's an instinct, okay. But they practice it.
Okay.
Just like...
How do you practice? I mean, once they fly off, how do you say, okay, get back here, let's try that again.
You release them from close distances and then later distances.
Oh.
It's amazing how they're able to find their way back. And folks who have studied this find that it's not just one cue that they use. They use several. And that different lofts of pigeons will have different cultural cues, like one loft of pigeons. A loft is where the pigeons live. In that loft, everybody kind of uses, maybe they use scent, they use sight, they use magnetic forces. And another one, they won't use scent at all. And they know this because scientists who are always mucking about with such things are constantly like stuffing things in their noses and making them wear little glasses. And in this way, measuring what is it that they're using, because they can't, if their noses are full of Kleenex, they can't possibly be using scent. Most birds don't use scent at all, but pigeons do.
They're known for their sound. Let's hear some sound from a pigeon. Now, I would have thought that was an owl or something.
I know what you mean, but this is not, you know, your typical bridge pigeon.
That's a red-billed pigeon.
That's right.
Okay. But
it's a communicate?
A
calming sound.
Okay.
Oh, yes, they certainly do. And birds' songs and human language are very, very similar. They're not the same thing, but they are shockingly similar. And I think this is why, of all the creatures that have ever lived on the planet, birds are the only ones who can speak to us meaningfully in our own language. Because music and language and even its ally dance are all things that both humans and birds love and need in some cases. I mean, certainly they need their own songs. They couldn't exist without song. So I've got a chapter on this as well. It's called Birds Can Talk, but we look at parrots specifically. But for birds, being able to communicate in a complex way is extremely important. And we're just starting to explore the ways in which birds communicate. It was much easier for us to teach the birds to communicate with us in our language. They were able to pick our language up much faster than we could pick up theirs.
Let's hear from a parrot, the yellow-headed Amazon parrot. It's a combination of a lamb, a baby crying, a squirrel in the tree.
Boy, and I was just in Schererville, Indiana, where Snowball the Dancing Cockatoo lives, and this is a parrot sanctuary for unwanted parrots. And you walk in there, and there are conversations going on in every imaginable way. Some conversations are in parrot. Other conversations are going
parrot.
On. There's one pair of birds in which one bird mimics the husband in the home where he used to live, and the other one speaks in the voice of the wife. And even though, alas, the wife, the actual human wife, has now died, the marital conversation continues. And this one parrot will say, "Larry, telephone." And the other bird says, "Oh, all right." And then apparently Larry had a little digestive problem and occasionally would emit some, the bird blows a raspberry. And the wife's voice comes from the other bird, and whenever the other one blows a raspberry, she goes, "Oh, my word."
there's a bird in our back door neighbor's yard. We've never actually seen it, but we hear it. And for the longest time, for the first two summers, I thought the phone was always ringing.
Jump
up, I'd run into the house.
Oh, yeah, they'll do car alarms. Out, yeah. They'll do all kinds of things like that. And crows, too. Crows can talk. People have taught crows to use 150 different words.
How do they speak human, though? I get
you know, without,
talking parrot and talking bird, but how do they do this? Like, they ventriloquism?
You mean physically? How
do they
well, as
say,
you know,
oh, Harry.
They don't have lips.
Right.
So how do you do it without lips? Interestingly, I go into this a little bit in the parrot chapter. Scientists can watch them uttering words with a special X-ray. It's a movie of an X-ray.
Uh-huh.
And where we would use our lips, they can use the inside of their throat. Now, birds have a larynx, but it's not used to speak. They have another thing called a syrinx, and their syrinx is equivalent to our voice box. It is their voice box. And they're capable with their syrinx of doing amazing things, including speaking two different notes at once. And around here, you probably have heard thrushes sing, hermit thrush, for example. And you can hear a thrush singing two notes at once, and that's because of the syrinx. So they make up for the lack of lips by having incredible flexibility in their throats and in elsewhere in their mouths.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Cy Montgomery, author of Birdology. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820. Cy, let's talk about the dinosaur bird. It was a great chapter because you worked so hard to visit this bird and meet it on its own terms, and you almost didn't.
Oh, yeah.
And you were getting ready to leave.
Oh, what an adventure that was.
Tell us about that and why it was so important to meet this bird.
Well, this bird is known as the cassowary. It's the most dangerous bird on Earth, and it kills more people than any other bird. Well, you think, you know, how many killer sparrows are out there? There are other birds that kill people, but this one is 150 pounds. It's a flightless bird, and the way it kills people is, if provoked, it can leap up in the air and slash you with its stiletto-like toenails from stem to stern. And it hasn't killed anyone in Australia since the 20s, but it does kill a lot of people in New Guinea, and I was in Papua New Guinea not all that long ago. But for the cassowary, I actually went to Queensland, Australia, and they live in the rainforest there. My first day in the rainforest, I thrashed around, and it's kind of a rough rainforest. There's a lot of poisonous plants, and there's some poisonous snakes, but I wasn't worried about that. I was afraid I wouldn't see a cassowary, and what would I do about Chapter 2? But I came back from that first day and was waiting for my friends to pick me up, and as they drove into the parking lot and saw me, this look of stricken horror crept over their faces, and I looked down, and I saw that I was covered in blood. It was from dozens and dozens of leech bites.
Oh my.
I hadn't realized that I was just covered with leeches. But I went back the next day, and the next day, and the next day, and the next day. And day after day, I would find their footprints. I would find their scats. But I wasn't finding the cassowary, and I was growing increasingly desperate. And then finally, the last afternoon before I had to leave the next day, I didn't see one, but I heard it. And it was the most amazing sound. I had heard it once before. If you'd saw Jurassic Park, did you see
Well, I was
going to
say, they remind me of the velocipedes or whatever. The
velociraptors.
Velociraptors from Jurassic Park.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly.
Which scared me to death, and they don't even exist anymore.
Well, they kind of do.
In this, exactly.
So the sound that they make is like an earthquake. You feel it in your chest. And the first time I heard it, researcher Andy Mack had played it for me in his car, and there was a cup of coffee sitting in the coffee holder in the car, and you could see the coffee like rumbling around in the cup. It's this ancient, infrasonic, thunderous, rumbling sound. And it probably is the sound that the dinosaurs made. In Jurassic Park, before all the dinosaurs rush onto the scene, you hear this sound. And it's almost identical to that that a cassowary makes today. And the reason I wanted so to see a cassowary is that cassowaries look more like dinosaurs than some dinosaurs did. But in reality, all birds are dinosaurs. Scientists today tell us that the dinosaurs didn't go extinct. They are very successful and among us today. And when you look at your feeder and you see a little chickadee, when you sit down to your Thanksgiving turkey, if you know you're not a vegetarian like me, you're eating a dinosaur. You're seeing a dinosaur. There are 10,000 species of dinosaurs alive today, and they are the winged flying dinosaurs. So that's why I wanted to see this bird.
Because this is the most obvious dinosaur.
Yes, it really is like coming face to face with a dinosaur. And, it, you know, in the book I'm trying to get across essential truths about birds, and I felt this was one of the most fundamental truths to get across. So I wanted to see this bird and to be with this bird. And then finally, on the last day, I did. I thought I'd lost my chance. I was thrilled I got to see, to hear the bird's voice. But the last day came, and I had walked through the forest all day, and it was time for my bus. And then I got a message at my hotel. The bus was late, and I had just a little while longer, and I went right back up the track where I had heard the bird call the night before. And it was then that the bird stepped out as if through a crack in time from the rainforest, and I was close enough to see its orange eye, the eyelashes fringing the eye. I could see the wattles, the red, bright red wattles on the bright blue neck waving around as it walked. I could see it pick up a huge seed and watch that seed slide down the tall neck. And I could see the shiny toenails with which it could have eviscerated me. But I wasn't the least bit afraid because I was just filled with the thrill of being face to face with a living dinosaur.
And he gave you a great chapter, having to look and search so long and hard for him.
Yes, indeed. It couldn't have been better.
We're going to take a short break. When we return, Cy, would you read something from your book for us?
I would love to.
Great. We'll return in a few minutes. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
You are a violent man, my friend.
After starring in the series The Shield, Walton Goggins is starring in Justified as a white supremacist who now claims to be born again and preaches to the federal marshal pursuing him.
At one moment, you could be breaking into the home of a fugitive. And the very next moment, you could be facing your final judgment.
Walton Goggins on the next Fresh Air.
Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Corporate partners help provide support for WOSU 820. Your business can join them and reach an educated, engaged, appreciative audience every day. Be associated with a trusted local and national source for accurate news coverage. For more information, contact Christine at 247-4469. And thank you for supporting WOSU 820 NPR News. And remember to get the latest information from our station the way you want it, daily, biweekly, or monthly. Go to WOSU.org/email and sign up for one of WOSU's e-newsletters. 81 degrees in downtown Columbus at 11:40 this morning. Sunshine today, a high right around 85. Clear skies tonight, a low of 62. Sunshine for Thursday and a high of 85. There is a slight chance of rain Thursday night and then more sunshine for Friday. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820, NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're live at the Olentangy River Wetlands Research Center at OSU today. Joining me in our beautiful 84-degree and twittering studio is Cy Montgomery, author of Birdology. She's going to be at an event co-hosted by the Columbus Zoo and the Grange Insurance Audubon Center tonight at the Grange Insurance Audubon Center at 505 West Whittier. For more information, go to WOSU.org/allsides.
we'll have everything you need to know about it. But, Cy, you did want us to let folks know that there's going to be live birds there, and you'll be with penguins, parrots, hawks, domesticated flamingos. Who knew?
Yes.
So if you love birds, the place to be is, of course, at the Grange Insurance Audubon Center tonight with Cy Montgomery. Cy, your new book, Birdology, why don't you read something from it for us? You wanted to read something from falconry class.
Yes,
you took.
Yes, this was part of one of the 7 adventures I had to write this book, and I took years of falconry classes. So I'm reading from a description of my first falconry class ever with a wonderful bird named Jazz.
And how long ago was this?
Well, I Jazz is no longer with us, but I was just with Nancy and her hawks 4 weeks ago.
Okay.
As I started this book tour. In fact, I had a hawk on my arm when I did the reading at my hometown bookstore. That was quite a thing, to be having a book in one hand and a hawk in the other.
How many people can say they've done that?
It was pretty great. Yeah. Okay, so this is from my first falconry flight class. We're out in the field across the street now, and Nancy, my falconry instructor, unclips the jesses that keep Jazz tethered to my glove. "Let her fly," says Nancy. I give Jazz a brief toss from my glove, and she sails into a pine. She looks down at us. Now I'm worthy of Jazz's interest. She knows something is about to happen. For the first time, I'm bathed in her sight. It's a baptism, and feels momentous, transforming. "Now call her in," says Nancy. She takes a piece of cut-up partridge out of a baggie in her pocket and places it between the thumb and forefinger of my glove. "Jazz!" she calls. I extend my left arm and look up. A huge, powerful bird flies toward me. Not everyone would like this, I realize. An exceptionally brave biologist with whom I've worked in Southeast Asia confesses that he would be scared. It's a genetically programmed human reaction, because birds like this once hunted and killed our ancestors. But as Jazz's talons reach for my glove, my heart sings. She lands surprisingly heavily for a bird. The squeeze of her talons is strong. Her piercing eyes are fiercely focused on the job at hand, tearing flesh with her beak and feet with an intensity that encompasses at once rage and joy. Though she's done nothing more than land on my hand, I feel she's given me a great gift. On my hand, I hold a waterfall, an eclipse, a lightning storm. No, more than that. Jazz is wildness itself, vividly, almost blindingly alive, in a way we humans may never experience.
That's from Cy Montgomery's new book, Birdology. That's what we're talking about today. In reading the book, you often refer to your experience with the birds as a gift.
Yeah, it really is. And it's a gift open to all of us. That's the thing. That's the wonderful thing about birds. They're all around us. As you pointed out earlier, they're the commonest wild animals that we see. Every one of us sees a bird every day. And humans have regarded birds as bringers of great gifts to humans for centuries and centuries. And in some cultures, they brought us news from all around the world. In others, it was God speaking to us, or the gods, through the voices of birds. And we all have access to this if we just choose to look and listen.
There is one bird that knows how to listen. Snowball went viral on YouTube, and I was acquainted with Snowball via YouTube a long time ago. And so when I read about him in your book, I thought, oh my gosh, could this be the same Snowball? I mean, how many could there be dancing parakeets? What kind of parakeet is
he? He's a cockatoo.
Cockatoo,
he's a
right.
Sulfur-crested cockatoo. He's, 14 inches tall, white, like the bird on Beretta, with a tall yellow crest. And he uses his crest as part of his dance. It's fantastic. He throws it forward. He has all these different dance moves.
It's like a headdress.
Yeah, it totally is. It's great.
Well, tell us about Snowball, how you met Snowball. Did you see Snowball on YouTube first and decide you had to meet him, or how did that all happen?
I found out about Snowball at the Pepperberg Lab, where Irene Pepperberg had worked with Alex, an African gray, for 31 years. He's a parrot who has learned to speak 100 words and use them meaningfully in ways that shows that he understands concepts, for example. He can understand the concept of color as well as identify all his colors. He can identify all his shapes. He can identify different materials, and he could at least until tragically he died. So I found out about Snowball there, and immediately I went on YouTube, and your listeners, I hope, are now frantically looking up Snowball the Dancing Cockatoo.
I hope so. We're gonna put a link to Snowball on YouTube on our webpage.
Well,
too.
If you are not having a good day, it's about to change the minute you see this cockatoo rocking out. He has several favorite songs, and one of them is Everybody by the Backstreet Boys. And when Snowball came into this parrot rescue
let's
place,
get it started. So, yeah,
oh, it's yeah. just it's just the best thing you ever saw. He actually had to leave the home that he'd been raised in because he had an issue with the little girl who had the temerity to grow up and go to college. Parrots mate for life. And what if your mate just walked out one day and didn't come back for weeks? You'd be livid. And Snowball was. And when she went to college, he was incensed that she just dumped him. And so when she came back, he attacked her and bit her. And so he had to go live with someone else. And when the dad of the family brought Snowball to Bird Lovers Only Parrot Rescue, he brought a CD and told Irina Schultz, who runs the rescue, just put this on and see what he does. And when she did, she almost fainted. This bird totally rocks out. And a lot of birds like to dance, but one of the things that she noticed right away is that he is exactly on beat,
right?
You know, in sync. And now there are neurobiologists studying this. And what Snowball shows us when he dances is not just that he has a great affinity for music, as many parrots and many birds do, but he's exhibiting an ability that is thought to be only shown in very high functioning creatures like humans. It's called beat perception and synchronization. To be able to sync to a beat, even when you take that same song and change the tempo, he can still continue to sync to it. And this was believed to be chiefly a human ability. It's not
true. And not all humans have it either, by the way.
Oh, did you go to the prom with the same
guy? Well,
I
was in marching band, and I probably went to prom with the same guy.
Gosh. But, you know, once Ani Patel of the Neurosciences Institute began to study this bird, he started looking on YouTube at all the other dancing birds and found that lots of parrots have this ability. So here we are, you know, in 2010. We've lived among birds since humankind has existed, and we're still making these incredible discoveries about their cognitive abilities.
And here's what is cool about Snowball and all the other discoveries they're making about dancing birds is they have a lot of moves.
Oh, yeah.
It's not just the sprinkler, by the way, and the, these are
right,
the things they teach
right.
in dance classes.
He's got a move that he's just made up recently that looks like he's blowing kisses. He brings his claw to his beak and then turns, and then he brings it to his beak and then he turns. And, you know, he throws his crest, and he uses his wings as well as his feet.
And he's learning new moves.
Oh, he's making them up all the time. And you can even see him thinking, hey, is this move going to work? You know, and he'll practice this stuff. It's just like a person practicing. And interestingly, when Alex, the speaking African gray parrot, was learning different words, they actually put a video monitor in that he couldn't see so that when no one was there, they could watch him practice words. And he did exactly what human children do. When they're alone, they practice sounds. They put together different strings of sounds. And he would do this with new words exactly like kids do. It's astonishing to me. And he would also like to rhyme. You know how children, how everyone loves rhyme. Everyone loves rhyme. Rhyme is almost like a kind of song, a kind of music. It's a kind of poetry. And parrots love rhyme. And they'll experiment with rhyme. And they're doing this even when we're not watching them.
Now, do parrots sing?
Parrots can sing. They can sing in words. They can mimic almost anything. But they don't have what ornithologists call a bird song. And most hummingbirds don't, a few do, but most hummingbirds also don't have what you call a bird song. A bird song is a very specific series of sounds linked in a special way with certain repetition, the same way that that not all music is a song. Whales okay. have songs, as you know. But we didn't know that they were songs because they had to be speeded up to sound like song. It was Roger Payne who discovered that humpbacks beneath the waves are singing songs that culturally change from year to year, as happens with birds. And birds have dialects to their songs. In certain areas, birds will sing their song this way, and in another area they'll sing it that way.
They have a twang.
Well, they okay. do. They kind of do. They're so like us in these, and we're just beginning to catalog these things.
The idea, one of the essential truths that you write about is that they're individuals, that every bird is different. And you mentioned that earlier, but it really came out in, for instance, your chapter on the chickens, the ladies.
Yes.
You learned personally about how they can individually affect the flock.
Oh, yeah. And roosters are easy to see how individual that they are in particular. Well, we had a very memorable incident with one rooster called Alex. And,
Alex is, yeah, well, it was kind of funny, though, too. I got to tell you. By the way, folks, you got to get the book and read it. Because
well, I could read a little from the Alex
the
section.
Alex
if
is,
you, want.
If you can pull out the Alex section.
Yeah,
Alex is a rooster who was doing fine.
Yeah, he was. We didn't realize that we'd gotten this rooster. We thought he was just going to be another hen. But then he started to crow, and we knew. And one day he thought he might attack my husband, and thought better of it when Howard stood up his full 6 feet. But we hoped it was a phase. But that it was not a phase was demonstrated by a momentous visit from none other than our pastor at the church where I was a deaconess. It was a rather momentous visit. Not only was Graham Ward my minister, we were friends, and I'd been very close with his wife, who had died tragically of cancer. But eventually, Graham found a new lady love, and one day brought his bride-to-be, Kathy, with two of her small children, over to meet our charming pig, our frisbee-playing border collie, and our affectionate flock of chickens. It was meant to delight both the lady and her children, like a visit to a petting zoo. But it didn't turn out that way. The pig, then about 500 pounds, bucked and thundered out of his pen, full of porcine exuberance. Kathy was visibly alarmed. "I didn't know he would be that big," she exclaimed. Christopher the pig ran to his main outdoor feeding area. We hooked him up to a tether so the kids could watch him eat a bucket of slops, because when it came to eating, he was a performance artist. His large tusks did not escape the young mother's notice. She took her daughter's hand. Her son was fascinated, but I was afraid the little girl might cry. But now, as if to our rescue, the ladies rushed over to share in the food bounty. "Here's someone more your size," Graham said to the little girl. "Watch, you can pat her." And as he'd done many times with our hens, Graham, dressed in shorts, reached down to pet one of them. Just like when I stroke the ladies, Graham started to run his hand down her back. And just as the hens always do with me, she assumed her distinctive squatting posture. This is a well-known chicken behavior, usually directed at a member of her own species. It's actually known as a sex crouch. It's a position the chicken normally uses to make it easy for a rooster to mount her. Just then, from another part of the yard, Alex the rooster looked up. The scene looked innocent enough to human eyes. Two small kids, three adults, a pig, several chickens, all standing around together on a sunny summer day. But through his rooster eyes, Alex saw a moral travesty, an insult to his roosterhood. The minister was trying to have sex with his hen. I only had time to cry, "Graham, watch out!" before Alex hit. Spurs first, the enraged rooster flew at the back of Graham's bare calves with the full force of his fury and broke the skin. His fiancée was aghast. The little girl began to cry. I carried Alex ignominiously away to the coop while Graham, bloodied, ushered his new family to the car. I tried to end things on a good note by handing the shocked children each a fresh egg to take home, but unfortunately, I later learned that one broke on the way back, staining the car's upholstery.
a disaster.
It was a total rooster-mediated disaster.
But edifying.
Yes, it was. It was. Boy, poor Alex. Oh, my goodness. And that was not, of course, my minister's intent at all. But it did look like it to him.
So where was poor Alex sentenced to?
Actually, we gave Alex to another hen house where they needed a lot of roosters. They were breeding exotic chickens, and Alex was an Araucana. He was a kind of exotic chicken, and he was a great rooster. He was terrific for his flock. All kinds of religious texts advise the faithful to emulate the rooster in protecting your family, because the rooster is just such a paragon of virtue when it comes to protecting and finding good things for your family to eat, showing them where they would go. The rooster will always call the ladies over and not eat himself. He'll say, look, here's something delicious, and he'll stand by and he'll be happy to watch them enjoy it before he even tries it. They're really, really very generous-hearted birds, but can't have sex with their hens.
We only have a few minutes left, but I didn't want to leave undiscussed the issue of crows, because they're a much maligned species of bird. Julie Zekefusan a month ago or so, and we've talked about
she's
that a couple
wonderful.
Times. She thinks you're wonderful,
too. I just love Julie's work.
She is. She's wonderful, and we always have a lot of laughs. But we talk about the crows, and we had a listener call up and talk about, you referred to pigeons as, you know, rats with wings, and that's pretty much what this fellow said, and you talk about that. And crows
are people don't like a whole bunch of big, black, noisy birds, and the listener is not alone in his feeling. But when I see a big flock of birds, like crows mass up in the fall, and I write about how in this one small city, the crows began to mass up in the fall and use as their winter roost the downtown of Auburn, New York. And people were disturbed by this because they had to leave their offices with umbrellas over them or they were going to be hit. But when we see flocks like that, one thing we ought to think about is that there used to be huge flocks like this flying over America. The largest number of anything there ever probably was passenger pigeons, and they would darken the sky. They would land in trees and crack branches with their weight, and we exterminated every last one of them. So when we see big flocks of birds, we need to think of it as a great natural spectacle and something of which we ought to be stewards. We have so much to learn from birds. It was a close relative of the crow, the raven, who the Norse god Odin used to send all over the world to bring him back news of his planet. One of the ravens was called Thought, and the other was called Memory. And if we lose the birds, it's like losing thought and memory.
And that's what the book's about, Birdology by Cy Montgomery. Cy, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
It's been
this
an absolute
great.
Delight. I hope we can meet again. Cy's going to be at the Grange Insurance Audubon Center. Learn more about that at wosu.org/allsides. They will be live birds there tonight, as well as Cy. And Cy's great with or without birds, I think. I want to say thanks to the folks at the Olentangy River Wetlands Research Center at Ohio State University. Thanks for their hospitality. We've enjoyed ourselves today on this beautiful, beautiful Wednesday. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820 NPR News.